Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their essential prenatal multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Monday, the 11th of March, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Sachin Oza, co-chief executive officer of Rhea Bold Resources, RBD is ticker, and Sachin discusses the significance of their oil discovery at Monroe Swell in California. Also on the podcast, Ian Murphy, full-time trader and author of Way of the Trader, A Complete Guide to the Art of Financial Trading, discusses his book. Like I said, he's a full-time private trader and he trades his own account using trend following, swing trading and day trading strategies, and he talks through those. Also, it's a Monday, so on the podcast today, Malky, oil and gas sector specialist, talking about the following companies: Victoria Oil and Gas, iGas Energy, Egdon Resources, Amerisur Resources, Rockrose Energy, Independent Oil and Gas, and Rhea Bold Resources. Plus, as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk with lots of other content. You'll see Zach taking stock, look at the chart. Zach Meir, that is. A video there on the front page. There's also a couple of other articles, like United Oil and Gas. And scrolling down here, and there's a SP Angel Morning View, falling China order sales offset by new energy vehicle demand. So lots of stuff on the front page at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Sachin Oza, co-chief executive officer of Rhea Bold Resources. RBD is the ticker. Sachin, good to chat to you.
Thank you very much for having me, Justin.
And it's a marked difference in the share price today from last week. And of course, I suppose the advantage of having a varied portfolio, you have lots of things going on. So let's just give us a brief summary before we get into the news that's perked up the share price. Tell us what you've got going on there, please, if you could, Sachin.
Yeah, so very quickly, I think, Justin, as a reminder of what we do, Rhea Bold Resources is an AIM-listed upstream oil and gas company where we focus on pre-cash flow projects with low technical risk. The capital we provide to those projects helps unlock them through near-term drilling and then converts them into value by near-term monetization after success. The result that we've had today in California is just a progression of that very trodden pathway that we've gone through, and is, I should point out, the third successful well out of three wells in the region, and certainly one that is going to form a significant cornerstone for future growth for the company going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go into the details of this. So you've got an oil discovery at Monroe Swell. Take us through what you've discovered here then.
I certainly will, Justin. But just again, to lay a little bit of quick background on this, we have three license areas in California in the Rehobald portfolio. There's Munro Swell, there's West Brentwood, and there's Grizzly Island. The two that I just highlight are West Brentwood and Munro Swell. So we began the work program in this project portfolio at Munro Swell, where we did well workovers. Those well workovers were not only helpful because they provided cash flow and generated the initial footprint for the company there, but it also helped de-risk some of the potential that we saw in the license area. But the first two wells we drilled were at West Brentwood, and as I said, very excited by those because of the success that we had there. And VG4 in particular, with the very high flow rates, is anticipated being hooked up and being put into production shortly. Mm-hmm. Now, if we look at West Brentwood and Munro Swell and the Munro Swell, if we look at Munro Swell specifically and the Burnett 2A well that we announced today, we were really pleased with that because the 60 meters of pay that we saw there was above the pre-drill estimate. And that just goes to show that this is likely to be a very extensive license area in terms of future reserve and production growth for the company.
Mm-hmm. So I'm looking at your presentation here, and on the Munro Swell, you've got an estimate there of an NPV of $100 million. So, now you said, what you've discovered is better than expectations, and that, I assume that $100 million is based on that lower estimate, is it?
That's right, Justin. So if we were to look at the overall pathway to get to that NPV number, we would have to drill the wells, test them, put them on production, and then roll out this future anticipated growth program and success. So the single biggest element of de-risking that needs to take place is that discovery well. And that's what's happened today. So this is the single most important point in terms of the de-risking towards that NPV number that you mentioned. Now, it's worthwhile just spending a little bit more time on that NPV number because it's clearly extremely high value per barrel. Now, for California in general, the economics are so strong because we have very low per barrel capital cost, we have very low per barrel operating costs, and the decline rates for these assets being conventional are not like the unconventional assets. In other words, you get a plateau production for a few years before the gentle decline that happens after that. And it's the combination of those factors that make these project areas some of the most valuable economics that we see anywhere globally. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Munro Swell area is such an attractive one now. And I'd carry on just a little bit further just to expand on both West Brentwood and Munro Swell. Now, when you look at the West Brentwood economics, these are driven by these two wells and is a less aerially extensive area than we have at Munro Swell. So what we would anticipate at Munro Swell is testing this well, drilling another set of discoveries, and then putting a number of wells onto production. They won't be quite the same level of the production rates that we have at West Brentwood, but because of these excellent economics that I described, they will provide fantastic value growth for the company in the months and years ahead.
Yeah, and so take us through, the process now. What's going to happen next here?
Yeah, so the forward program, as I described, will be a period of testing of this well. Yeah. We'll put a timeline out on that when we have greater certainty of when that's going to take place. Just bear in mind, as we've been carrying out this work program, we've been doing it under extreme and severe weather conditions. And many of your listeners might have heard of all the rains that are taking place in California and in this region in particular that have delayed the ability to execute the plan as quickly as we would have liked. But we are very pleased that Integrity Management Solutions, the contract operator over there, has been able to execute as quickly as they have despite these conditions. So we will provide that timeline going forward, but very soon thereafter, and potentially even concurrently, we are working on the next well being drilled in the license area. This is a two-well earn-in program for Munro Swell, and we are so excited by this result. It is fully possible we accelerate when the drilling of that second well takes place. So those are the immediate two pieces of news that will come out, as I said, in the weeks ahead. And after that, we will have to sit down and really evaluate both West Brentwood and Munro Swell, the best way to start deploying our capital to capitalize on this future growth potential and value creation that we have now established in the region.
Yeah, and does this include looking at other targets as well?
Yeah, so it'll break down roughly as follows, Justin. So because we've had this extensive pay within Munro Swell, we clearly have to understand some of the other horizons that have potential within the existing portfolio. We've already established that that's the case at West Brentwood in some of the messaging we've provided about the productivity of that area. And so it's growing what we already know we have in this portfolio, the potential that exists in other horizons in that portfolio, and other project areas which are complementary to what we've already established as a strong footprint in the Sacramento Basin in California. So it's all three, but it will be done in a very organized, thoughtful, and value-creative manner so that we can deliver the best value upside for our shareholders.
Yeah, but you must be very pleased, though, for this.
Oh, I mean, we're extremely excited by that. And as I said, you know, to have had three successful wells and each of them having exceeded our expectations in one form or another, it's clearly a fantastic anchor for the value of the company and as I said, for the future growth potential of the company as well.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose, you know, just to reiterate, going back to sort of, you know, last week, you know, some people still took that as negative news, but you're still saying, aren't you, that, you know, you have to evaluate that at the moment. It can still be commercial. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. And Justin, you highlighted this in the question that you'd put out earlier. When we discussed that, the question was how and what is the plan for taking the asset, and in this case, Coulter South, forward. Mm-hmm. And because we'd had a slightly unexpected and therefore surprising result, we have to do some evaluation work before we can properly assess how best we do that. That is not to say it's not going to be taken forward. It's not going to say it's not economic. Both of those statements are not true. We believe quite the contrary. It's just going to take a little bit of time to do so. However, on the other side of that, when we have unexpected results like we had at Munro Swell, from the point of view of being exceeding our expectations, we still also have to take the time to know exactly how to move that forward. But while we do that, we know we can get significant near-term production growth from the areas we had already identified as having the potential pre-drill. So, you know, when you put all of that package together, when we take things, when we make discoveries in areas like California, we know we can convert that into value quickly. The project areas which have this bigger bang upside, like Coulter, we can take our time to figure out how best to monetize them. But at no stage is the Rehoboth shareholder not exposed to significant activity from everything going on in our portfolio.
Yeah, marvelous stuff. Well, last thing to do, or last three things, I should say, Sachin. If someone is listening to this, likes the sound of what you're doing, but are not yet following the story, given those three quick reasons why they should hit that button, that follow button on your page on Vox, and add you to their watch list, please.
Yeah, Justin, and as ever, we've pretty much run through that the three reasons already. But to summarize them at the end here, one, we have a very active portfolio of near-term drilling that has taken place, which will lead to future production growth and value creation for our investors. We have a series of wells coming up in regions like Romania and in West Newton in East Yorkshire, as well as other wells in California, all of which have significant potential and indeed transformation potential for the company. And finally, we continue to evaluate new opportunities which are complementary to the existing portfolio of projects that we have to carry on that exposure that we are bold investors have to significant upside.
Marvelous stuff. Sachin, good to chat to you again. And always busy, so no doubt we'll be catching up again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Ian Murphy, full-time trader and author of Way of the Trader, a complete guide to the art of financial trading. Ian, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Justin. Good to be here.
Now, the book is not out yet, is it? It's out in April, is that right?
Yeah, it's just rolling out now. It'll be available on April 15th.
Okay.
And e-books and that are starting to roll out now as well. But the actual publication date is April 15th.
Excellent. Well, tell us about yourself first. I mean, you're a full-time trader. I mean, how did you start? No one starts a full-time trader. Of course, it takes years and years. I've got to laugh. People come into investing or trading and they think it's an easy game, and it doesn't. It takes discipline. It takes years of work. It's like any trade. But so how did you start? How long did you start, and why? And when did you start doing it full-time, Ian?
Yeah, good question. Most private or professional successful traders, when you speak to them, have been through the mill, and they all approach the market from different perspectives and with a different background, but we all seem to end up in the same place.
Yeah.
Having gone through it all, I kind of, like a lot of people, Justin, I drifted into trading. In the mid-90s, I started to dabble in the markets because I worked for US firms in Ireland, Westinghouse and Verbatim. Mm-hmm. And that kind of got me into stocks. And I think, like a lot of people, I was execution only. I was dealing with a traditional broker over the phone.
Yeah.
Analyze stocks over the weekend, give them orders to buy on Monday, and then watch them like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And go on.
Yeah. Then I kind of, in the late 90s, I started to get more serious, and I opened up an online trading accounts with some of the usual brokers and went from one to the other. But then we had the dot-com bubble burst in 2000, spring of 2000, around this time of year, and, you know, gave me my first big shock. Because, of course, I had the tail end of the boom that when I went in and thought it was simple, you just invest and sit on it. And, of course, I didn't realize at the time the difference between investing and trading, which are two very different activities altogether.
Yeah.
So
when you say I'm an investor, and I say that sometimes I do have a panto of a trade on a stock, never normally works out because it's a different discipline. But so when you say investing or trading, what's the difference in your mind?
Two very completely different things. Investors are involved in whatever sort of financial assets they are, you know, whether the financial instruments in the markets, or they could be investing in property, investing in art, investing in wine and whatever. And they're looking to get into something when the price is low, below value, and then stick with it until the price increases. Mm-hmm. Trading is completely different because you're looking at short-term movements, either on the long side, which is the price going up, the short side, the price going down, or a mixture of both. You can be both long and short the same instrument at the same time. Traders also have to think in terms of liquidity, because depending on the size of the account you're trading, it's not every financial instrument or every asset which can give you the liquidity you require to execute your trades when you want them at the price you want them.
Yeah.
Investors tend not to think of that so much. And I think most people, they think of investing, they begin really with real estate, and the primary asset or where most people have their money tied up, certainly in developed Western economies, is in their family home. And then they might buy an investment apartment or something. Mm-hmm. And that creates a mindset around what investing is about, looking for to grow and increase value over time, which is a kind of a bad habit. Well, maybe that's not the word, but it's something that you shouldn't really bring into trading. The example I use in the book is like a farmer who drives his tractor onto the highway. Because it's a completely different thing. And this is why I think so many new traders get burned so quickly when they enter the markets with an investing mindset.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, you can, because, for example, there's one particular trading strategy I use. I call it a tidal strategy, which is a very long-term strategy. And it's more like technical investing rather than trading, because I use specific technical indicators to, you know, trigger me in and out of trades.
Mm-hmm.
But whereas investors, when they enter the markets, tend to rely on fundamental analysis. You know, there's a new product coming up. It's going to disrupt this industry. They want to get in, early. And then the problem is they never know when to get out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, fundamental data can be imprecise. It lags. As well as that, the way the financial markets function is they rarely respond as you would expect to underlying financial and economic news. Often they respond the way you'd expect, sometimes the opposite way, and sometimes in no particular order.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's often not a direct correlation between fundamental news and data, and it doesn't manifest as you would expect in the markets. So they're kind of connected, but at the same time detached in that regard.
Yeah.
That's kind of really where the difference between trading and investing comes down. Another thing is, you know, investors should or have or would have a diversified portfolio across different asset classes, across geography, and across currencies. Traders tend to trade one single financial instrument over and over. For example, I tend to trade the E-mini futures in the States a lot, or geared ETFs.
And I would just what did you say there? I don't understand what you're trading. What are you trading?
Futures contracts in the States of the S&P 500 index.
Oh, okay, I understand. Yes.
Yeah. For beginners or people who are new to trading, ETFs would be a much more accessible, similar thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And what they do is they track an underlying index.
Yeah, yeah. So would you say then that, we'll go into your book now, but would you say that becoming familiar with a certain kind of, instrument or index or, effects is the best way forward? So, stick to something like the S&P and get to know it. Is that the way forward?
Exactly. That's what I recommend. When somebody wants to make the transition into trading, what I would recommend is stick to blue chip stocks and trade them on the long side. Mm-hmm. Because most people have already dabbled a bit in the markets before they get seriously into trading. So they know the market, and then they need to concentrate on learning the technology of their trading platform. They don't have to learn a new market as well. Yeah. So I'd highly recommend blue chip stocks. Trade them on the long side. Go on longer time frames if you can. Weekly trend following strategies, I would definitely recommend for beginners.
Yeah.
And because the stock market defaults to the upside in the long run, the chances of your long trades working out are higher.
I love that phrase, because a lot of people don't understand that. And that's, the stock market defaults to the upside, and it does. And that's why I think being an investor like myself, if I've read a company and I know it back to funds on the fundamentals, I will always look at charts. I love charts, and I look at charts for entry. But I know I can't be right on a daily basis, but hopefully the odds are in my favor on a long-term basis, because their fundamentals are improving. And like I said, as long as they do keep improving, as I've said, I should be on the right side of the trade. That's what's hard about trading, isn't it? When you're in the short term, the daily volatility, intraday volatility, is hard to pre-guess. And then people get offside and they start to panic, they sell. And so, the stats of new traders, it's phenomenal. The failure rate I'm talking about. I've said previously, and I'll also say this, our biggest provider in the UK says 81% of retail investors lose money on CFDs and spread betting. And that's quite scary, isn't it? Because I'm assuming people go into this and do not know what they're doing. So it's let's start off, say, part A, for example, of your book. And it's called The Way of the Trader. And there's a bit of a sort of Buddha sort of feel to that. We'll go into why that is. But you've broken it down into three parts, part A, part B, part C. So what is part A about then, Ian?
So what I wanted to do with this book was essentially write to myself in the past. I'm over 20-something years involved in the markets, and now I'm trading full-time, having made this journey from a lot of losses, a lot of hassle, a lot of confusion and frustration, and now I'm in a position where I'm consistently profitable, and it's what pays the bills for me. So I wanted to write the book that I wish I read 20-something years ago. So I put a lot of thought into it, and I broke it down into three sections. Part A is the first part you meet as you work your way through the book, and it's about what trading is really about. It's about a trader's lifestyle. It's about a trader's relationship with the market. And I think this is something that is not discussed and is misunderstood, and I wanted to get that out there straight away. Mm-hmm. And like I quote in it, you've just mentioned there the rate that the high percentage of retail traders are losing money. I quote a number of studies from Poland and France. I also quote figures from some large brokers. And depending on how you crunch the numbers and who you ask, it is between 80 to 90% of retail traders are in a loss position at any given point in time. Now, that figure is incredible. If I was to say to you in the morning, take a flight to Paris and there's an 80, 90% chance it'll crash, you wouldn't take it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly. And I don't think people understand the stats either, because it's almost like, that is complete gambling, isn't it? It's like saying to someone, okay, you're going to bet on that horse. It's only got a 10 to 20% chance of winning. Do you want to go with that one or one with better odds? People wouldn't bet on it, you know, generally. I mean, you know, if you had to do that for a living, you wouldn't even try to, you know, deal with those odds, because it's odds against massively, you know?
Well, that's in part A, I deal with that exact issue. What is trading and what is gambling and what's the difference? And how do you know whether you're doing one or the other? And the perfect example is to think of an insurance company and think of an actuary at an insurance company. And what they do is they examine a market and they identify the risk that they are prepared to take because they're more likely to profit from it than to lose from it. That's exactly what an insurance underwriter is. He's trading in risk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, you know, people always, when I tell people what you do for a living, I'm a trader, and they say, oh, that's gambling, isn't it? No, yeah. If you're doing it correctly, it isn't.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, trading when done properly, and this was a big surprise to me when I went to the States and started to work with, you know, serious professional traders trading big accounts. Trading when done properly is actually quite boring.
Yeah.
They don't get a buzz from it. They find it interesting, yes, and they do their data and their analysis and they execute their trades. But it's not particularly exciting for them.
It's a system, isn't it? You know?
It is. And you know what? When you're doing it right, it can be a bit of a grind. Mm-hmm. And for example, I'm a trend follower, and weekly trend following is widely considered to be the most profitable style of trading.
Yeah.
And some of the most famous traders, that's how they trade. Mm-hmm. And when you're trend following and you get into a good trend and your position is going well and you're trailing a stop under it, and then on each pullback, you can either increase your position or, you know, make your decisions as you go along. There's not actually a lot to do. Yeah. For example, I've been in a daily trend following position in the S&P 500 since the first day when we came back this year, 2019. I have a strategy that triggered. I look for six signals. They all lined up, entered the position, and I was stopped out yesterday. And because it's a daily trend following strategy, every day after the US market close, which is at 9 o'clock in GMT, I just need to move up my trailing stop by a few points, and that's it. Mm-hmm. So literally... And that trade closed out yesterday just short of 20% profit. I made 20% profit between the start of the year and yesterday for doing literally 3 minutes work each evening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And therein lies the problem, because people do not have the patience to sit through that, and they don't have the discipline. Because what they do is when the one trade is up, they go off looking for something else to do to busy their time.
Yeah. Do you know what? Ian, do you know what? I'm sorry to cut it. I was chatting to another book writer recently, and he goes into psychology as well, Dr. Daniel Crosby. He said, the trouble is, humans' brains are hardwired to do something all the time. And so when you get people like Warren Buffett saying, you know, most of the time he doesn't do anything, that's the hardest thing of all, to sit there, sit back and relax and let the market do what it does, or your system do what it does. We are sort of as humans, aren't we? Hardwired to keep on messing around, you know, and tinkering, you know?
There's a very, how shall I put this diplomatically? The best traders are a bit odd. If you think about it, you have to be. Because if 80 to 90% of people who are trading the markets, retail traders, are losing money,
yeah,
the other 10 to 20% must be a bit different. And the other problem, Justin, is people who are drawn to the financial markets tend to be above average intelligence, inverted commas. They also tend to be tech savvy. Those are the types who are drawn to technical analysis. They also might have a background in business, finance, or accounting, and those people tend to be drawn to fundamental analysis. Mm-hmm. So they're clever people. Mm-hmm. They're usually as well, you know, in their 30s, a lot of people get drawn to trading, particularly in the States, as they come close to retirement and they want to manage their retirement account. So they may be coming to the end of a successful professional career, doctors, lawyers, accountants. They've got money. And they've learned throughout their life, with a bit of intelligence and hard work and graft, you can get ahead. That does not work in the financial markets, mm-hmm, because none of the normal social rules apply. Mm-hmm. And that's what trips people up. So this is why the psychology of trading is so important. Mm-hmm. And as well, you know, when I listen to myself saying that, I've heard so many years people saying psychology is all about trading. And whenever you go along to courses or read books, it's always psychology, psychology. It's one thing knowing about psychology. It's another thing actually applying it in your real life. Mm-hmm. You know, you said there, we humans were very strange. We all know smoking is bad for you and it will kill you, but we smoke. We all overeat We all gamble. We all do things we shouldn't do. We know flying is statistically the safest way to travel, but even statisticians have a fear of flying. So there's this huge disconnect between we know what the big picture is, but how we apply it in our daily lives. It's like the smoker will say, yeah, I need to give up smoking, but I just have this cigarette. Yeah, I need to go on a diet, or I need to clean out the garage, but I just have this extra dessert now and I'll clean out the garage tomorrow. And because the market operates on multiple time frames simultaneously, you can get your fix in the short term today, but it will undermine your account profitability over the long run. Mm-hmm. So yeah. It's this kind of strange ability to hold multiple time frames in your head, to act, to know when to act and know when not to act.
Yeah.
And to see the long-term picture and the short-term picture together.
Yeah, and in your book there, you broke it down into different parts. Part B, you say you reveal the habits of serious professionals. And is this the kind of thing you do, just saying what they do and what you have to do?
That's exactly it, yeah. There's kind of 10 parts in it, and it's numbered sequentially in Part B. Part A is a kind of introduction to the job of trading and the relationship and what it's really about. And you know, most traders are at home in our office or we're in a rented office with other traders. What's the lifestyle? In Part B, then, I systematically go through the processes and procedures that successful traders use. And I have it numbered sequentially because you need to work in a sequence. And the chapters are 1 rule, 2 choices, 3 styles, 4 legs, 5 stages, 6 edges, 7 records, 8 checks, 9 filters, and 10 tools. And each one of those chapters then breaks down into what you need to do. For example, the chapter called 1 Rule, and this really is the only rule of trading. It is the preservation of capital. Mm-hmm. That is at the very heart of trading, and people right from the outset need to get that hardwired into their brain.
Yeah.
You know, there was a conference in Dubai there recently where they had a meeting of family offices. These are people who handle, you know, the money for very wealthy people, private investment funds. And the consensus around, you know, people in the room are generally asked, what do you see your primary role as? What's your main job? And you would think it's about diversifying your portfolio or increasing our money by 10-15% a year. They all identified that their primary role is the preservation of capital, not to lose money. Mm-hmm. And a guy from the States summed it up and he said, you only need to get rich once. After that, it's about managing it.
Yeah.
So the same applies to trading. You only need, in theory, to fund your account once. After that, it's about the preservation of capital.
Well, when you think of it, it's 3 parts of the equation, isn't there? There's actually losing money, it's like keeping your money, there's making your money. Now, if you strike off losing money, then you can't go far wrong, you know?
This is it. And people always say this, and it's about, you know, and in the next chapter actually is called The Two Choices. And the choice that people always face when trading is a loss of opportunity or a loss of capital. And people always are afraid to lose the opportunity. That's the one you need to let go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Keep the money, lose the opportunity, because the market constantly provides profitable opportunities.
Do you know what? I agree with you. And do you know what? I'm on Twitter, quite active on Twitter, and the majority of people, and I deal in small caps, which is a bit like trading, I suppose, but I look for companies that are, you know, starting to generate profit and will be a profitable company long term, and so I want to hold for long term. But the amount of people I see jumping on trades when the share price has spiked and they have fear of missing out, and that is it. Fear of missing out is probably the biggest problem that new investors or a lot of investors have, and when they jump on a trade thinking the share price is going to go up 600% in a day. It's gone up 100% already. It never normally does it, and they think, oh, I shouldn't have done that. And it's the emotional side of it, isn't it? Really, that, you know, if you can just, like I say, if you've got a system in place and it's a cold, hard system written down that's proven and you stick to that, it takes the emotion out of it. But the emotion is our downfall, isn't it?
Exactly, it is. And, you know, there's an old trading saying, either run fast or don't run at all. And this is the problem. You're either trading on a short-term basis where you're in and out quickly, or you're trading long-term with trend following strategies and your stops are set so far down the chart that you can take 20, 30, 40% drawback and still be in the position, because when you originally entered, your risk profile was set in such a way that you could absorb that much of a loss. And these are really the basics that people only find out the hard way. like you say, but taking the losses, and they enter when the stock is overvalued, you know, when they should be buying it when it's oversold.
The
example I use in the book about the difference between price and value, you know, price is what you pay for something, value what it's actually worth. And they both weave in and out of each other. And when they cross over and get to their extremes, that's when you need to enter and exit your positions.
Take us through a bit. I like the bit in the it's called The Way of the Trader, and of course it's a nod to, you know, Buddhism there. So what is the nod? What's obviously it's to do with the mind, and I think, you know, like we just discussed, it's all about psychology, all about emotion. So take us through into that, if you could, Ian.
Yeah, it is all about psychology. And like I said, the people who are drawn to the markets tend to be a bit tech savvy or tend to have a background. So I compare that to somebody who brings a calculator to a therapy session, because you're applying the wrong tool to the job at hand.
Yeah.
And in the chapter, The Six Edges, I call it the psychological tools of a successful trader. I've studied and practiced Buddhism for now for about 20 years. Well, I say I practice it, in theory I do, but every now and then I like a Big Mac like everybody else.
Yeah.
But when I started to trade and started to work with coaches and that, I was amazed to discover that the psychological tools they were talking about, I had known them already going back, because when you think about it, it's the same. When you're applying your mind to a task, the tools you use should be similar. And when trading, people always talk about, in the psychology of trading, they talk about patience and discipline. And there's an old method for training the mind in Buddhism, often for transforming the mind, people often say, because training the mind can kind of put people off a bit. And it's called the six paramitas, or what's known as the six transcendental perfections. Now, that's a bit of a mouthful, but basically these are six tools that you use for working with the mind in any application. And they are generosity, discipline, patience, diligence, concentration, and wisdom. So what I did is I unpacked each one of those and showed how they can be applied to the markets, and how you can trade successfully using these tools.
That's interesting. And one final thing, Ian, on your last bit there. You imagine, you talk about strategies, and that's very important, isn't it? You say you follow a trend strategy. So for people not aware, what does that mean? Are you looking at moving averages? What are you doing?
All trading breaks down into three styles. Trend following, swing trading, and day trading. Now, people don't maybe not be aware of this, and most people are daily swing traders, whether they realize it or not. Trend following is very simple. You just get a trend. As I said, the stock market over the long run defaults to the upside. You just get into a position and you stay with the trend until it ends. And a good trending stock, or a good trending market even, have two things in common. The trend always goes on for much longer than people expect.
Yeah.
And there's usually a good fundamental story behind it. And, you know, we can pick any number of stocks which have had incredible trends, like, you know, Amazon off the top of my head recently. And even, you know, the S&P 500, as it bounced off the financial crisis, 2009, and recovered, you look where it's gone to now.
Yeah.
Even after the famous Wall Street crash, there was an incredible trend. So that's trend following. It's the easiest to learn. It's the easiest to make money on, but it is the most difficult to follow, because people lack those six edges: generosity, discipline, patience, diligence, concentration, and wisdom. They lack the six psychological tools to trade that strategy. The second most common style is swing trading, and this is usually daily swing trading on the long side, where people are looking for a stock which they think has reached a point, we say has bottomed out, and then is looking to bounce, and they're going to just grab a fixed move, I'd say, over 5-6 days. They might hold it over the weekend, they might not. And then the final trading style is day trading, where people are going in and out of a position in the same trading session. And they should be in the same trading session, not holding it overnight. And those trades can last a few minutes or a few hours, and depending on the market they're trading. That's the most difficult style, day trading. And for many people, when you mention trading, for them, you know, day trading is synonymous with trading in their mind, and that's not necessarily the case. I actually don't do a lot of day trading. As I said, I'm primarily a trend follower. I'd say since January up to now, I've probably done 15, 18 daily swing trades, no more. I've done no day trading.
Yeah. And you can say trend following is probably the most successful. I mean, people don't know about this, but there's a famous, wasn't there, experiment called the Turtle Experiment in the 80s,
yep.
where the guys put together, Rich Reading here, Richard Dennis and William Eckhart put together a bunch of guys, and they started off with less than $5,000 and turned it into more than $100 million by using trend following. Like you say, trends are very strong, and they go on for longer than you think. But that's good. Let me just ask you then, final question. I mean, last night I punched out a chart on the S&P 500 on Twitter, and I said, look at this, doesn't look very good. I said, if you look at the moment, the share price here, we've got a head and shoulders pattern, looks like. First head is the start of 2018, first shoulder, 2018, or January 2018. Head is September 2018, and we've just had the second, this shoulder here in February here. And I said, it's never ever, in 6 months, in the last 10 years, only twice in the last 10 years has the S&P share price gone below the 200-day moving average within a six-month period. That was in 2016, we've had volatility there, and just after the financial crisis, where we started to recover. So what do you think at the moment? I mean, do you look at the chart like that, or is it more on a minute scale? Do you look at more, you know, a longer trend? And if so, what do you think of the S&P 500 at the moment?
Okay, I generally avoid traditional technical indicators. I don't use trend lines. I don't use head and shoulders patterns. I found over the years that I've been through them all. And coincidentally, you mentioned there about the turtle traders. And the title of my book is a nod to the turtle, because I mentioned they're mentioned in the book. They tend to work with ATR, average true range. And that is a very strong part of what I do. And I use average true range channels in most of my trading. I practically stick it on everything. And the idea behind that is that you look at what the average range is on a financial instrument over a set period of time. And when it goes outside the average, it's like kind of going off its footpath. It's doing something out of the ordinary. Mm-hmm. So on the S&P 500, for example, I've been trading two strategies at the moment. I've had that daily strategy on the long side, which I entered in January and just was stopped out yesterday. But on the short side, I also entered a short position on the S&P 500 last week.
Okay.
Yeah, and these are all triggered by ATR channels when stocks, and in this case an index, is moving outside its average range.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I've just popped an ATR on my chart here, because I've never really looked at it, but I do like that. It's a powerful looking indicator.
There's also, you know, people would be familiar with the resistance and support levels on a horizontal basis, but ATR channels really offer excellent resistance and support as well, particularly the 1 and the minus 1 ATR channels. And you'll get a lot of very good triggers to enter daily swing trades on the at the minus 1. When you've a washout of the minus 1 ATR channel, price drops down, then closes higher than the previous day, especially if that's accompanied by a price squeeze. And I have a strategy I call the diesel strategy, because diesel, when it's squeezed, explodes. And it's called on that. When you get a washout in price at the minus one ATR, price compresses. If you can get a good entry there at that very sweet spot where the risk is lowest and the reward is highest, if you can get a very nice position in there with a tight stop, and if you can catch that explosion upwards, you'll do very, very well over a period of 3 to 4, maybe 5 days. Mm. And That's another place where ATR channels come in very handy.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Ian, it's good to chat to you. And your book is entitled The Way of the Trader, A Complete Guide to the Art of Financial Trading. It's available now. You can get it via, I'll put the link on the blog on the post here, at harrimanhouse.com / Way of the Trader. But thanks for chatting to you, Ian. And hopefully we'll catch up again in the not too distant future.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great to talk to you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is oil and gas sector specialist Malky. You're right, fella?
I'm very well indeed. Thanks, Justin. And you?
Yes, I'm not too bad. I mean, a bit chilled. I mean, I'm running outdoors in the mornings, and it's nice to see the sun come up. Anyway, but
yeah, indeed, very nice.
Anyway, let's talk about news out. What's happening, Malky? Kick us off.
Yeah, well, it was a big week for news. The oil price didn't change very much, but it was a big week for news, and led off by Victoria Oil and Gas, who've been sort of very much down in the doldrums lately. It's not been a a good performer in my bucket list. But Victoria Oil and Gas, just to remind you, is based in Cameroon. Supplies gas to the largest but second city, port city in Cameroon called Douala, through its significant Log Barber gas play, which has obviously a gas production plus pipelines into the town and the city. And they supply just a bit more than half of the gas to the major local power station called ENEA, which is funded by the government. And just over a year ago, January of last year, for all sorts of typically African reasons, ENO cancelled the contract. Didn't mean to say they were going to getting the gas from anywhere else in Cameroon, apart from water-based energy supplies. They only really have things like diesel and that sort of stuff. So it was always going to come back. It just took a long time. It was presidential election year, so money needed to be going in different directions, if you know what I mean. And so they spent the last year really struggling. But this year what happened, was that they got the contract back in January, and ever since then the power station has been running at exactly 100%. So they're selling way more gas than they thought they were going to be. More importantly, last week VOG announced the refinancing that they've been needing to do for some time. I'm actually quite surprised the shares didn't rally quite a lot more, because they did a decent sized refinancing, raising just under £14 million at 13p, which was a very small discount. And so they had really good quality investors coming in here. Kevin Fu, the chairman, has resigned as a result of all this, been replaced by Roger Kennedy, who's a very good guy. It's rightly described as a sort of new beginning for VOG. They've strengthened the financial position, and they'll be able to kick on with all the things they need to do. They've had savage cost reductions. So the chairman, the new chairman, is on 50% of what the last guy was. The CEO has taken a 33% salary cut, and other cuts in London and in Cameroon are being made. I've spoken to one of the people who put this deal together. There's no doubt that they believe that it is a very exciting future for Victoria Oil and Gas. Now, I do know, because I get emails from them quite a lot, it's been a long old run for shareholders in VOG, and they haven't rallied very much at the moment. But I'm sort of continuing to remain extremely positive, and this is what I was waiting. I've been waiting for a long time for this. So they will have new equity in the business and the ability to use that for working capital and for all the capital projects that they've got, which they haven't been able to do recently.
Yeah. I mean, the chart there is literally, it's been declining for a long time now, isn't it? And like I say, hopefully this is the funds they need will hopefully get them off the bottom here, you know?
Too right. I think that's certainly what they're going to have now. And obviously the market's hardly going to race away just after a raise, but I think that in terms of what it does, it settles it very nicely. They'll be bring on two new non-execs to work with the new chairman, and it's Africa, but they're in a very strong position.
Yeah, it was an all-time low. It's never been this low, the share price. So with the new equity, the new shares in issue, they're valued at, 37 million is the market cap. Marvellous stuff. VOG. What's next, Marky? Are you surviving by the way? You seem like you're just about surviving there, by the sounds of it.
Just surviving, yes. I've had a cough for the last few days, and I'm hoping it's going to last me through the interview.
Yeah, hopefully.
I'm sticking with gas for the next one, which is iGas and Egdon Resources. iGas primarily because it's the operator of the Springs Road gas, onshore UK gas well in the East Midlands. Mm-hmm. And we've had a bit of a tickle on this one in the last few weeks that they might have been some success there. They've announced that they've found hydrocarbon-bearing shale sequences of over 250 metres in length, which is very substantial. And they've taken out the gas out of the upper and lower Boland shale prospects. And that's only the first two. There's still a potential tertiary target to look for. They'll work through this and all the bits and pieces at the moment, but they've got this, you know, without any doubt at all, a very decent gas find here. I mean, their press statement today says this is a significant prospective resource for the East Midlands, and it will contribute very substantially. And it's pretty much the first time that we've seen anything onshore in the UK that might be substantial enough to deliver a decent amount of gas to the country, you know?
Yeah.
So,
well, the share price is up nicely. It's up at just shy of 15%. So the market's recognising it. But you reckon more to go on this?
I would have thought so. I mean, we're going to find out in due course quite how extensive it is. And if the tertiary comes in as well, then I think that it's a very decent discovery indeed. I know what the company were expecting. I saw the CEO the other day. If it comes in like this, we don't forget we did also have a decent discovery from Quadrilla recently, and we know that INEOS have had a look at one or two things. And in terms of, we are buying our gas for, for heating the houses. 80% of all the houses in the UK have their central heating with the gas. Mm-hmm. We've been buying it from Russia. We buy it from Norway. We buy it from Qatar. We've even bought gas from the United States in the last few months. Yeah. The idea that we could find some gas and in the East Midlands isn't such a bad bet.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it would help the market. Yeah, absolutely. So it's IGAS, high gas, of course. Anything else, Marky?
And Egdon are in that as well with them. So.
Oh, yeah. Egdon, okay, cool.
And they've had a pretty rough time, so this is good news for them as well.
Yeah, it's quite a few junior producers, explorers producers, have had a hard time of it late, haven't they? Well, especially the explorers. But, it's a bit of a tough market at the moment, I think, isn't it?
It is, and it's not all fracking, that's the other thing. I mean, if you've got a really decent find of gas in the East Midlands or wherever it happens to be in Lancashire, and you can prove that even if you do fracking or you don't, it's safe. Imagine what the impact is on local, because of course quite a lot of the money and the tax goes into the local area. So, yeah. Providing it's being done safely, it must make sense. But that's for more grown up people than you and me to decide.
Exactly. right. What's next, Marky?
I wanted to briefly mention that Amerisur Resources came in with a very substantial upgrade of its reserves last week. If you remember, they've had a big discovery on what they call CPO5, which is their block to the north of Colombia. The rest of their stuff is down towards the south. They put 1P, i.e. proven oil resources, up by 27.8%, and 2P, which is 50% given, up by 23.6%. There have been a lot of people watching Amerisur recently after the discovery, and of course they also had a farm out to Occidental, which gave them $100 million of cash to bring forward their drilling program. So they're in a very strong position. This will, this is an increase in production, which is despite the fact that the company produced 2.7 million barrels of oil last year. So at the end of the year, to put, you know, your reserves up by sort of 25-odd%, having produced so much oil already. They're drilling all over the place, in particular in CPO-5. I would have thought there's nothing but good news to come from this company, which is well-funded. You know, we talked a few months ago about the fact that so much money was coming in, you know, 5,000 barrels a day at $70 a barrel or whatever. They may have had to pay out the dividend. But actually, you know, what they've done now is found a way of bringing forward you know, various parts of the drilling program, along with Occidental, and then finding it themselves, along with ONGC, which is the Indian state company. So, very positive there.
Absolutely, and I think the bottom was there in that share price at 10 pence. Nice round figure. It often happens that. Around about a nice round figure, and bounces back out, but bounced nicely now, that's 16.94. Anything else, Margie?
Yeah, brief word on, we had an interesting situation last week with a company called Rock Rose Energy, which I've talked about before. Yeah. This one is suspended at the moment because of the deal it's doing, buying the Marathon, the US company Marathon are selling their UK reserves to, or assets to Rock Rose. Mm-hmm. And they made a potential bid for a company called Independent Oil and Gas, which you and I have spoken about before. The bottom line for the bid is that Andrew Austin has decided it, rather than go in and farm into the Independent Oil and Gas acreage, which is on offer at the moment, it'd be better for him to buy the whole company. Mm-hmm. And he's still tabled a bid of 20p a share. Which is a pretty reasonable bid, to be honest. I think the bottom line for him is that it would complement his portfolio. He hasn't got much gas in it, and IOG is a very much a gas play, and also it would extend the lifetime, and you know, bring on a decent portfolio. I've always liked IOG for the portfolio of assets it's got in the southern North Sea, and I've always thought that they would struggle to finance it, because if a development there, they're going to have to raise 250 million quid at least. And a few days ago that they announced that they were thinking more about farming out rather than funding it all themselves, which is the first time they've ever said that. Mm-hmm. When you're in a situation like that, you do leave yourself a bit vulnerable. And in IOG's case, in particular, because they've funded everything so far with a pile of debt from one company called London Oil and Gas, which is backed by a company called London and Capital Finance, which has got the unfortunate situation at the moment of having gone bust and being investigated by the FCA. Mm. So you might find that your debt situation, IOG quite rightly say that there's nothing, you know, all their debt is ring-fenced and there's no problem, which there won't be. But they do find themselves having to now sort of fight off a bid, as well as try and sort out the bottom line of actually doing a farm out for say 50% of their assets and get carried for it, to avoid having to raise any money. All in all, I suspect what will happen here is that if there isn't another bid, I mean, there must be a number of people looking at this to see whether £27 million, which is the value of the bid, is too cheap. It's certainly very attractive at these levels, and they find themselves in a very difficult position. I won't judge right now. We're at the beginning of this process. We'll have a look as we go through the process. I'll keep you informed as to what's going on.
Yeah.
But it's the most interesting position in the market. And yet again, as you know, we've had some more potential M&A activity in the sector, because, of course, you know, we're having seen Faro get taken out, and we then saw Ophir getting taken out. And last week, Soco announced that they'd made an all-share bid for Ophir, which had been turned down by the board without referring it to the shareholders. And now we're getting this. So there's a lot of corporate going on in the sector, which is you know, which is good news, because it means people are buying companies because they think they're too cheap, and therefore the share prices should go up.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Anything else, say, Marky?
One more quick one. There's a company called Rehobold Resources, which has had a rather sort of what you might call good news, bad news weekend, really, because on Friday they announced that the well, which is called Coulter, which is in Dorset, off the Witch Farm discovery, they had previously drilled the well and gone on the wrong side of the fault and got on the south side of the fault, where they said, it's not what we're expecting, but we've actually found oil here. So on Friday they announced that the well which had been set to try and go on the other side, a sidetrack as it's called, had actually gone on the other side, and there wasn't commercial oil on the other side at all. Mm-hmm. So the irony is that the one that they didn't intend to drill, they got there by mistake, has come in with a discovery, and the one that they thought was going to be the discovery isn't a discovery. Now, it's going to take a while to get all this sorted out. And I think in the meantime, you know, the market, you can see from the chart, the market was down sharply on Friday. We don't know whether there's any value in total to this. My spies tell me that the idea of the 15 million in the original well, 15 million barrels of oil in the original well, is pretty much guesswork. I think they've got a lot of work to be done on all this. I think it was right to knock the price on Friday. But would you believe it, the way that these things happen, they were also drilling a well in the States called Munro Swell in California, and that's announced as a successful well this morning.
Yeah.
That's come in. California, of course, it's onshore, so whatever it's going to produce there, we think it's got 60 metres of pay, which for an onshore hydrocarbon discovery in the States looks pretty big. And, of course, you have a situation there whereby it's onshore, the kit is all available. That could be producing in a matter of days almost. And the payback period for US onshore wells is very quick indeed. So one of the things that Rehobold has been attracted to me is that it has a portfolio of interesting acreage. They just got a bit unlucky to being in with the first well called Wick was in the package, but not really. It was something that came with the package. It was a bit high risk for what they would normally do, and that didn't come in. Coulter has been a sort of bit of plus and a bit of minus, but they've had at least their position in the States has been justified with this announcement this morning.
Yeah.
So I still like Rehobold. It's a smart couple of guys who run it, and they should be okay.
Yeah, well, do you know, Sachin, I spoke to him actually today, he's on the podcast, and they know what they're doing, and they've got a plan there, and like I said, they're quite diversified, and but they said exactly what you said there, there's a bit of work to be done on Coulter, but hopefully, you know, people sort of ruled out the surprise. It was a surprise of the announcement, really. Like you said, the primary target didn't show anything. Luckily, they discovered, you know, something Coulter South there, which may be commercial. But so, but there's just the confusing messages that came out. It wasn't as planned, and it's true, everyone.
And Stephen, who's the other joint CEO, made the fantastic comment on Friday. He said, a lot of people have been saying that we drilled the well in the wrong position. He said, we didn't drill the well in the wrong position. It was the fault that was in the wrong position.
Yeah, exactly. That's why it's called a fault.
Thousands of years of geology, and it's the fault that went put itself in the wrong position.
Marvellous stuff. It's a bit like that, you know, do you remember that Eric Morecambe thing? And in fact, Andre Previn just passed away, and he said, you're playing all the wrong notes. He said, I'm not playing all the wrong notes. Fantastic, but I love that saying. Marvellous.
Well, them in the wrong order.
Yeah. I mean, all the right notes, just not in the right order. Yeah.
Yeah.
Marvellous stuff, Marky. Thanks for that, fella. And anything else? That's it. Yeah.
My pleasure indeed. Look forward to doing it again.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. At five, Gulf Keystone Petroleum. GKP. Is it GKP? Couldn't say that, honestly, though. I couldn't think of the word K. At four, Photon Star LED, PSL is ticker there. At three, I had Sachin on, Rehobold Resources, RBD. At two, Red Emperor Resources, RMP. And number one most followed company is Proactis Holdings. That's PHD. Okay, time for the top five most liked and most read RNSs. At five, Ascent Resources. Permitting update. At four, Jangada Mines. Vanadium drilling update. At three, Rehobold Resources. Of course, I talked to Sachin. All discovery at Mono Swell. At two, Europe Metals. Scoping study economics for the Toral project. And number one, most liked RNS was from United Oil and Gas. They expand their portfolio with Benin Farming. And you can see an article on that on the front page of Vox Markets. That's voxmarkets.co.uk. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their essential prenatal multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.